and what implications? So maybe let's go on to a different one. How about the ones that were difficult for you guys, the split domicile ones? What made them difficult? So I think that's interesting. Like, to the extent I listened to this group negotiate, there was a whole lot of discussion about the party's expectations. And my, just as an outside observer, it seemed to me that the thing that drove the negotiations was that both sides at the bargaining table were trying to anticipate what the party's expectations were and conform the law to the party's expectations. I mean, that really seemed to be the prime. And you might have disagreed about what the expectations were, but you didn't disagree about how you were going to resolve the problem, which was apply the party's expectations. How about your group? To what extent did the party's expectations about the law or reliance on the law factor into your decisions?
I think that was also part of what they would expect to be subject to, like, an X driver driving an X would generally be, would expect to be subject to that.
Anybody, when you went into this discussions, I mean, because remember, you're a person who feels passionately about this issue. Anybody concerned about vindicating the underlying policies which you felt so passionately about that you voted as a legislator and then agreed to be on this crazy negotiating commission? Yes.
Sort of, I mean, in that the, one of the biggest differences between the two approaches is the comparative negligence, non-comparative negligence. Mm-hmm. So thinking about the injured party. Mm-hmm. Would be the ones most likely, I guess, to be affected, mm-hmm. by which state would apply. So I guess in that sense, it kind of shaped what we would be negotiating for.
And to what extent, so the injured party's expectations or the was significant, you think, in the negotiations?
Well, and also just the policy goals of either approach are sort of reflected in the two different kind of comparative negligence.
So here's the thing. I think you guys may have effectively demonstrated some of the problems with Baxter's theory. So Baxter's theory, comparative impairment, his theory, he agreed with Professor Curie that when there was a true conflict, courts lacked the institutional competence or authority to actually weigh competing policies and decide which was the better policy. You know, unlike Professor Leflar, he wasn't like, I'm going to pick the policy I think is the best one, maybe constrained by some of the things we talked about, but still, he thought, somehow, some way, courts have to resolve these true conflicts. And so his theory was, while you wouldn't weigh the underlying policies and say the strict liability is a better policy or the common law negligence is a better policy, what a court could try to do is figure out, given the facts of the case, which state's policy would be more impaired, would suffer a greater interference if its law wasn't applied. Now, his theory was what we just did. He wrote a law review article and he said, what courts should do is presume that if the state legislators in the two competing jurisdictions got together, they would negotiate a resolution based on just that. They would figure out in which cases their policy interests would be most impaired and advocate most vigorously that the law should apply in those cases. And as a concession, in the cases in which their policy interests would be least impaired, they would say the other state's law should apply. And that if all the states agreed to this, each state could maximize, to the best extent possible, its own underlying interests. You remember one of the things I was saying at the end of the day when we were talking about the law of the forum always applying was that it's kind of ad hoc, right? If your goal as the state is to have your policy goals furthered to the maximum extent possible, the forum law doesn't necessarily achieve that because you have no control over which plaintiffs decide to file in your jurisdiction. And so it's just happenstance. The cases, the types of cases to which your law applies ends up being just a matter of happenstance, which plaintiffs decide to file there, which may not necessarily be the best cases for your goals. So if we just took law of the forum, it may just so happen that the only cases that get filed in state X are cases where the two parties involved are from state Y. And if we have the law of the form as the resolution, that means every time you apply state X law, but that's the only cases that you ever see. And so that's the only time state X law applies. That's probably, according to you guys, not what you think the most desired outcome is. Right? The most effective way to further state X's policy goals, because that's the one that you're all willing to say, apply a Y. So that was his concern. And so instead we had to think about this from the other side, which is, what would the states think were the most important cases for them to have their policy apply? Knowing they can't win it all, right? No state's going to agree to just sit down and say, my law never applies. There's going to have to be some concessions. And so they would fight to have their law applied to those that were the most important for their policy goals. And that the legislators would sit down and do that. Okay, well, two things. I want to work through the cases and see to the extent that you think that that's really possible for courts to do that, to do this comparative impairment, and do it in a way where the courts really are not actually just outright weighing which policy they think is a better policy or providing any predictability, and then come back to this idea about expectations of parties. Because all that being said, I think you guys stumbled onto something really good here about how states might actually try to resolve these disputes if they can do it through compact or treaty as opposed to through judicial decisions. So let's try to at least understand what Baxter had in mind and how courts have applied it, if I can ever get this off. Bernard versus Harrah's Club, which is actually towards the end of the readings for today, is probably the most famous example of this idea of comparative impairment. The case, if you remember, as I said, involves the plaintiffs who the plaintiff is an injured California resident. He was injured in an auto accident in California. It turns out the defendants had gone over the border to Nevada, been served to the point of intoxication and then some at a Nevada casino, came back and got into the accident in California. And the question ultimately was whether or not the casino owners could be held liable in addition to the negligent drivers. I mentioned this before in class, not surprisingly, California is a jurisdiction that has a dram shop statute, or actually I think they've done it by common law, but it allows the tavern owner to be held liable if it knowingly or recklessly serves a patron who's intoxicated. Nevada, not surprisingly, does not allow. In fact, has affirmatively, the court tells you, through judicial decision, refused to impose liability, civil liability, on taverns. Okay, we all laugh. I think it's not surprising. Why is it you think that the Nevada Supreme Court, which is elected, in case you're wondering, was not willing to impose civil liability on tavern owners for negligently serving or over-serving patrons?
Besides just the hospitality industry, I would assume that gambling is also dependent on lots of alcohol.
Anybody gamble? Anybody have friends who gamble? Do your friends who gamble sometimes get free drinks while they're gambling?
Yeah, I work at a casino.
Even better. You don't even have to talk about friends who gamble. You can just talk about others you've seen. And the business model is?
Give people as much to drink as they'll drink. So they'll keep gambling.
Keep gambling. Yes, yes. My strategy, of course, is to pay the lowest amount of money to gamble as long as possible for the free drinks. But always staying in the casino so I can walk home, of course. But, okay. And let me tell you, you know, if you don't know this about Nevada, and it's been in the news as of late because it's really a problem, Nevada has no state income tax. Their state revenues are almost entirely generated by sales and occupancy taxes. And up until fairly recently, the state was quite flush as a result of revenue based on sales and occupancy tax. And all of that was coming from casinos, for the most part. Casinos and satellite businesses, the restaurants, the shops, the other things that people patronized while coming into Las Vegas to gamble. So Nevada wants to encourage people to come in, to gamble, to do all those good things, and might be fearful, right, also, of imposing liability on tavern owners, because if they're ultimately liable, they won't continue to operate their establishment, or at least, if the business model's true, they won't be able to operate their establishment as profitably as they have in the past, which means a decrease in revenues. Now, the court's not quite as crass as that, right? The court talks about protecting the tavern owners from excess liability, boundless liability, but of course to promote industry within the state. It actually turns out the Nevada Code has another reason why it thinks the dram shop acts are a bad idea, and that is it also wants to just reduce the amount of litigation in and of itself. This actually kind of spawns parallel or additional litigation when an accident occurs, and it's just a bad idea to have a lot of litigation. On the other hand, why might a state like California choose to impose liability? Because after all, you know, it's not like California is full of teetotalers. There are bars and restaurants in California as well. Why do you think it is that California would choose to impose liability on tavern owners?
They're a huge state, so they might have a greater interest, or may not have a strong interest, I guess, in just protecting one faction, one industry.
And what is that countered against then? So the tavern, restaurant, bar industry perhaps doesn't have as significant a lobby as it does in Nevada, I'll give you that. But that still doesn't, if they're the only people speaking about dram shops, right, then even if your casino industry is a small slice, they're likely to be heard. What else is going on here?
Yeah. It's the purpose of protecting the public and people's property from people getting drunk, basically.
Yeah, so California is taking a strong stance to try to protect or deter, reduce the number of accidents and injuries caused as a result of drunk driving. Anybody think there might be something else going on? Yeah.
Spread the risk away from people who get hit by drunk drivers, so if the drunk driver's not insured, whatever.
And that's the other thing, right? To provide, we talked about this before, to better provide for adequate compensation, likely the tavern owner will be solvent. You can't always be sure that the negligent driver herself will be solvent, or will at least have insurance, right? Will have insured against the risk. So the California Supreme Court starts out just like we've seen in all the interest analysis cases we've read before, trying to figure out whether either state is actually interested in the sense that applying that state's law will further these policy goals we were talking about. This, it looks like both states are interested here. In what ways will applying California law further California's goals of deterring drunk driving, reducing accidents related to drunk driving, and better ensuring adequate compensation for victims of drunk driving accidents?
Make the argument at some point that just because they are neighbors, that California would have an interest. I guess California's returning to the state.
I don't even think it necessarily matters. I want to come back to why they make a point about them being neighbors. But I don't think it even matters just on a base level. If California is interested in deterring negligent driving and accidents related to drunk driving, I suspect the California legislators would want to do that everywhere they could. But at a bare minimum, what do they want to protect? In California, right? It'd be great if we could influence driving in Oregon and Nevada and New Mexico, but at a bare minimum, we want to influence the way people drive here in California. This is an accident that happened right here in California, right? So to the extent that we're interested in influencing conduct, this is right here. This is in our wheelhouse. This is what we're looking for. Likewise, I'm sure that if we had the California legislators here, they would say, all things being equal, we'd like to make sure everybody in the world who gets injured by a drunk driver has adequate compensation. But at a bare minimum, at our basis level, we want to make sure that our citizens do so we don't have to pay. But again and again, the injured party here, the guy in the motorcycle, is a California resident. On the flip side, if we had the Nevada legislators, the Nevada Supreme Court justices here, and we said, okay, why is it so important to you that there's no dram shop liability? We just think it's unfair. It's ridiculous to impose that burden on tavern owners. They're running a lawful business. It's the fool who keeps drinking who's responsible, ultimately. Why should the tavern owner be responsible for his behavior? Presumably the person's 21 years old at least and is an adult. We don't want to expose them to that excess liability. We're worried that by exposing them to the excess liability, it'll discourage people from going and actually opening these types of businesses. We think they're good. We think people should have them all over the place. But at a base level, our fallback position, we want to at least make it such that people can operate taverns and casinos and bars and restaurants here in Nevada. And, you know, whatever. It would be nice if people did in California. Maybe not, because then everybody has to come to Nevada, right? Well, that's exactly what's going on here. To the extent that you think dram shop liability will in any way affect a tavern owner's decision about whether it operates, applying that, you know, dram shop here, as opposed to the no dram shop, is going to affect the behavior of someone who's operating in Nevada. Both states are interested. Each a true conflict. Here's where the court now says, now we have to figure out how to resolve this. We need to look at which state's interest, which of these goals will be comparatively more impaired. Again, we're going to just start from the assumption that these are two valid but different policy goals, policy balances. It's perfectly valid, okay, good for California to err on the side of protecting injured parties at the expense of tavern owners. On the other hand, it's just as equally valid, good, a perfectly respectable choice for Nevada to make the other balance and to err on the side of protecting the tavern owner instead of the injured party. But we just have to figure out which is hurt more. Well, the California court ultimately decides to apply California law, which tells you it thinks that California's interest would be more impaired in this case if its law is not applied. How does it get there?
Asking California citizens to come into the state.
So this comes in. The court makes a big to-do about the idea that this particular tavern owner advertised specifically to California residents, solicited their business, and it looks that like that's why the drivers in this case did actually come to the Harris Club, because they saw the advertisements. Why is that significant? And so now I want to come to why I think you guys may have stumbled onto something in your discussion. To what extent does that have anything to do with interference with Nevada's goal of protecting tavern owners, if not outright promoting the industry in Nevada? It doesn't. So what does the court have to say about the relative frustration of interest or not frustration of interest? The court tells you a couple of interesting things about Nevada, which I think the notes in your book tell you, but perhaps it's in a different book, are actually inaccurate. One thing the California court tells you is that although Nevada doesn't have civil liability, doesn't have a Dram Shop Act, it has a criminal statute. And tavern owners can be criminally liable for serving intoxicated people. Why do you think that matters? Why does the court throw that nice little tidbit in there?
Because then they're not adding a duty to it already.
Okay, so in terms of the frustrating the purposes, we're not interfering with Nevada that much, because after all, what you're saying is that we're going to make these tavern owners be responsible and take measures to avoid over-serving intoxicated people. But at the end of the day, Nevada does that. It just does it through criminal statute. So, sure, they don't further this purpose through their civil laws, but they do it through their criminal laws, so what's the big deal, right? We're not interfering that greatly. That's why that's in there. What else does the court tell you about California interest here? Yeah.
It said that California cannot reasonably effectuate its policy if it does not extend to out-of-state tavern keepers who advertise to California residents.
On the one hand, you know, we've really imposed no additional burden on Nevada tavern owners than they already have, so we're not really interfering. But think about our goal of reducing drunk driving accidents. How can we possibly achieve that goal if we can't regulate the accidents that happen in our state because they were caused by people who were drinking somewhere else, knowing that they're drinking? Our goal completely breaks down. We can't do anything. And Nevada, it's valid, but you know, we're not interfering with it so much. That's the idea of comparative impairment. Now, you can think a little bit critically about whether you really buy what the court is selling here. On the one hand, the court says, well, since Nevada already imposes a duty, just adding a civil duty on top of a criminal duty is not a significant interference. On the other hand, you know, we really need to worry about compensating our injured parties and making sure they're compensated. Well, this is a case where there actually is multiple defendants in the case. One, not the only reason, but one of the reasons it was brought in California was because the driver is in the lawsuit as well. Could you make the same argument about California's policy goals, right? To the extent that California is worried about providing compensation, there is a source of compensation for this injured party, and the tavern owner's just providing additional compensation. Maybe. So maybe it's not the best logic ever to say this. In fact, that's exactly the first case, the Eggers case, is exactly that, right? Thank you. myself one other question about this Bernhard versus Hera. How many people think that if the injured driver and the tavern owner had both been from Nevada, but the accident happened in California, how many people think the court would apply California law? If both parties, common domicile, were from Nevada, but the accident happened, which could happen, right? Show of hands, how many people think the court would apply California law to a case involving two Nevada defendants in an accident in California? If the court's serious about the regulatory interest, it has to, right? If the reason that California's interest will be so greatly impaired is that need to regulate what happens on the roadways, then it's got to do that. Yet not too many of you raised your hands. Many of you instead suspect that the court would apply Nevada law given the common domicile, which leads me to say, why? Is it because if there's a common domicile plus the conduct happening in Nevada, there's two? Or is it because there's something about common domicile that you think is perhaps really important and compelling beyond what the underlying state goals are? Or something else? What makes it compelling? Something different than what I actually heard, at least this group for sure, but even your group to some extent talking about. So some people have suggested that that all that modern interest analysis really does is the first restatement was very territorial based. The idea is that the state is just trying to protect its territory, and modern interest analysis is the state is trying to protect its citizens. And it will apply its law to the extent necessary to protect its people who are domiciled in the state. Don't care so much about people who are domiciled elsewhere. And that would be consistent, right? If both the parties are from Nevada, then what is California care? Again, if the court's really serious about the regulatory interest that it's saying is driving its decision, then it ought to care, and it ought to put California law. I think there's also this idea of parties. You know, I asked you, why is it you think that he puts all that stuff in there about the fact that the tavern owner is soliciting California residents and knowing full well that California residents are coming to drink at its bar?
That, I mean, he should have or did plan his, I guess, exposure to sue.
I think it's two higher order goals supporting the application of California law here more than this idea of California's interest. And that is, in part, the party's expectations, which is certainly, it turns out, when you guys sat down to negotiate something that was pretty important to both states. The other thing is that ability to predict and prepare for the loss. As between the injured California driver and the Nevada tavern owner, who ex ante, before the whole thing happens, is in the best position to avoid the loss, prepare to absorb the loss. So let's just think about avoid. Let's assume you are general counsel for another casino in Vegas. You know your client wants to advertise and actively solicit people from California to come because that's a good moneymaker for them. You've got to advise them what this decision means, right? This decision means, to the extent you do that, you should know that if anybody leaves here, goes back to California, and gets in an accident, you're going to have to pay up. So that's job number one, advise them of that. Two, so what do they need to do to prepare themselves, given that you know that that's their potential legal liability? And that's the second part of your job. You get paid a little bit of money to tell them, oh, just so you know, you could be held liable. What you really get paid for is to tell them what to do about that.
Tell them to be really
Okay, you tell them, look, this only, you're only liable if you negligently serve someone. So you need to have some processes in place to prevent that from happening, which might be one. Is it possible for the Nevada tavern owner to avoid serving intoxicated patrons from California? So everybody is supposed to be 21. Well, everyone's supposed to be 21 to be in their gambling. Secondly, everybody's supposed to be 21 to be drinking. So what should your client be doing anyway? And if you card everybody, what might you notice? Somebody has a California driver's license. Could you not say you need to have extra precautions? Maybe you just put precautions in place about over-serving generally, but to the extent that you're worried about this excess liability in California, put some precautions in place so that your staff knows if you card a person who has a California license, boy, make sure that person is not drunk, visibly drunk, right? Have some place, some system to monitor the amount of liquor you're serving to them.
This is too off-culture. I mean, is there an ethical dilemma if you're serving out there? You're saying if they're from California, be careful. If they're from Nevada, you know, put a bottle in and just...
Well, I would... necessarily advise them to put a funnel in, right? But it's not unethical to advise them of the fact that they have greater legal exposure for serving someone from over-serving someone from California. Again, for a whole lot of reasons, you probably don't want to advise your client to over-serve anyone, but you need to have some extra precautions because of the extra liability. So yeah, right? To the extent that you know that extra liability is there, and despite your precautions, something might slip through the cracks. What do you need to advise the casino owner? Yeah, you need to find a way to insure against that risk. And ultimately, if it turns out, I mean, so the business part of this, you advise the client, say you have to take a good hard look. How much money do you actually make off of the business you solicit from California? How much it will cost you to avoid the potential exposure and decide whether or not it's willing for you, whether or not it's a good business decision for you to continue on. But here's what you need to do to avoid that liability or protect yourself. So was it possible for someone to avoid this? Right? Some degree, if the casino owner knows with some degree of predictability, then perhaps the casino owner can prevent this. Now, one of the things we said right from the start, one of the positives about a good system of choice of law, one thing we might try to achieve is predictability. Predictability is that reason such that people can structure their transactions and their affairs to avoid liability or prepare to avoid liability. So that might be a good reason for the rule for ultimately drops. The justified expectation. We talked about that as well as a reason why we might adopt a choice of law principle. And this perhaps does seem to fit more with someone's justified expectations that if you are actively going in, soliciting residents of the state to come in, drink willy-nilly, and then send it back home, you might ultimately be held liable. And conversely, the discussion I actually heard in your group, if you're the poor guy on the motorcycle driving in California, what crazy expectation do you have at all that some guy from Nevada, some guy who's been drinking in Nevada might be or you are less prepared for that risk on the front end. I mean, you have insurance, right? But to the extent that you can amplify your insurance specifically against that risk, you're less likely to do that. You're also less likely to have the expectation that you're going to be subject to Nevada law when you're sitting there riding your motorcycle in California and never having ventured into Nevada. That might be what's really going on. Let's just take a minute and walk through one more of these. Try to get a handle on what comparative impairment is. Now that we spent a lot of time talking about why it might not work, it would have been better if I were able to do that the other way, but anyway. How about we take a look at the Briscoe versus Arlington County case. A case, a police officer from Virginia gets involved in a high-speed chase and follows a suspect into, ultimately, into D.C. and as a result of the officer's kind of negligence, the suspect is able to get in a car accident and seriously injure a guy who turns out is from Maryland but works in the district. And it turns out also that Virginia has stronger sovereign immunity law, so that under Virginia law, the county itself is not liable for damages in this case, even if the officer ultimately is responsible. Conversely, the district has waived more sovereign immunity such that the county may be able to be held legally liable. I say may, you gotta be careful about what the provision is here. D.C. sovereign immunity. Anybody pick up on what the court tells you the D.C. sovereign immunity statute provides? D.C. has waived sovereign immunity, but a limited extent, the municipality or the county can be liable if a state actor basically just refuses to do something he's told to do. Like, there's absolutely no discretion. You must issue this document under all circumstances, and the guy just refuses to do it. Still, that's in contrast to Virginia, which has no liability for the municipality, for the county, the municipality at all. The court does tell you, though, that the officer ultimately can be individually held liable, even under Virginia's law. Can be held liable for money damages, just not the county. Okay, so does the court ultimately decide to apply D.C. law or Virginia law in the case? Ultimately, the court decides district law applies. How does it get there? First of all, what does it think are the respective interests of the two jurisdictions? Why does it think that D.C. has less sovereign immunity, has waived more sovereign immunity than Virginia?
They said because they're unique geography, that they have interest in protecting people who work in
the United States. Yeah, that becomes important later, because in order to create an interest, they really have to actually fabricate an interest, even based on the purposes for their law. But maybe start over on the Virginia side. Why does he think that Virginia has, or at least had for some time, pretty robust sovereign immunity? Why not allow the municipality to be held liable? Okay, so that's a big part, right? It's preserving the resources of the county. Hey, don't laugh at that, right? That's an important thing. To the extent that there's not sovereign immunity, you and I pay more. Or we don't pay more, but we get less services. This injured party takes money that otherwise goes to support county services, be they roads, be they schools, be they whatever other services that the county provides. So the county has a reason, or the state has a reason why it wants to protect the county's resources. What else?
Well,
I think something we mentioned at the classes ago that could possibly
Yeah, in fact, there's a, if you pull up any law review articles on sovereign immunity, Professor Brown's work or a whole host of other people's work, generally the debate academically is less about protecting county resources and more about that other point, right? Drawing the proper balance between deterring bad acts on the part of state officers, but also ensuring that state officers are not constrained, inhibited in performing the duties we want them to perform.
Issue with that is I was thinking about the same thing, but the fact that the officer can still be personally liable.
And the court thinks that's important too, right? The court uses that fact very nicely in crafting its comparative argument for exactly the reason that you said, right? So first of all, if we just look on the surface and we say, sure, the county we want to protect the county's resources, we want to avoid over-deterring police officers, this looks like a good case for applying Virginia law, right? Certainly, the county's a Virginia county. We want to protect, Virginia wants to protect its county's resources. But even to the extent, remember, the chase starts over in Virginia. The guy is working for a Virginia county, and he's trained over in Virginia. You know, part of this is about, we don't want the individual actors to feel constrained. We also don't want the county to be so concerned about liability that it has a training manual that says, under no circumstances should you do anything to ever try to apprehend a suspect, because we don't want to be held liable, right? We want the county to feel like it can train its employees a little bit more aggressively. And so to that extent, this looks like a good case. Now, on the flip side, DC has some counter reasons why it might actually waive its sovereign immunity. As much as we don't want to deter police officers from ever, ever, ever chasing bad guys, we also don't want them to be crazy, right? And so DC has waived its sovereign immunity a little bit more than Virginia to actually deter some types of acts. Virginia provide sovereign immunity at a cost. This is really about allocation of resources, right? So we taxpayers, we don't have to pay any more money and we get the services we like as a collective whole, but some poor injured party is stuck holding the bag, right? At the end of the day, there's a guy who was seriously injured as a result of this police officer's actions. DC draws that balance a little bit differently and is willing to say some of that compensation has to flow from the municipality. Now, to the extent that DC is interested in deterring bad conduct, it kind of has an argument that it's interested in this. On the one hand, you could say, well, the municipality's conduct really all over there, train the guy. But this is in part just direct vicarious liability for what this officer did, and what he did that was bad happened in DC. In part, but here's where the court has to do a little bit of fabrication, to the extent that DC is interested in adequate compensation for injured parties, a little tougher, except not totally a stretch, because this guy has a substantial connection with DC. Granted, he doesn't live there, but he's connected in a substantial and meaningful way because he works there on a regular basis. And so the court says, okay, we've got an interest here too in ensuring compensation to this guy and to other people who come into the district frequently, especially given the unique geography. Given that there's a good chance small number of people live in the district, a much larger number of people that spend time in the district live outside in Virginia and Maryland, there's a good chance that people that get injured in here are people who work here as opposed to people who live here. Maybe that, maybe not. Okay, now to the point about, so we're gonna presume as a starting off point that both of these are equally valid policy choices. All we want to do is figure out which policy choice will be harmed more if its law doesn't apply, And you're right, the court says, much like the California court says, well, it's true Virginia doesn't want to over-deter police officers, and applying D.C. law might have that effect, except, at the end of the day, Virginia will impose individual liability on this cap. Which is more likely to deter his actions? The fact that the county may be held liable, or the fact that he may be held liable? Well, we think the fact that he might be held liable. So just adding the county's liability, that isn't really frustrating the goal of adequate deterrence all that much, because this guy's already concerned about liability when he acts. So, not so bad. You know, we're interfering, but just a little bit. On the other hand, if we don't apply the DC provision, then we have no adequate way to ensure that these bad guys, these bad cops from Virginia and Maryland, don't drive in here and wreak havoc in the district. We have to be able to deter people. We have to be able to provide adequate compensation, after all, to people who come into the district and be injured as a result of all these bad actors. Now, again, I think this doctrine's subject to a little bit of manipulation, because you could say the same thing with respect to the compensation. Wait a minute. The individual officer is ultimately liable here, so there is a source for compensation. We're just fighting about an additional source of compensation. And so if I were representing Virginia, I might say, come on, right? You're not being that significantly imposed upon if Virginia's sovereign immunity law applies, right? Same thing, right? The court says, well, it's true, we're going to waive sovereign immunity, but you know what? We just do it a wee little bit. It's just for those non-discretionary acts, so it's just not really a big deal. We're not interfering that much. We're only extending liability this much further than Virginia has. You say the opposite, right, too? So you're not really deterring. You're just deterring a wee little bit. And so Virginia's not really interfering all that much with your wee little bit of deterrence. So the idea on the surface is that you're weighing the relative impairment of the two states and not weighing the validity of their interests. But note an interesting thing. One of the other things that the court points out for you, actually two things that are interesting. The court points out that Virginia has actually altered its sovereign immunity case statute, just doesn't apply to this case. Why might that be significant, you think, to the court?
Because it shows that the interest in having sovereign immunity has actually been abandoned by Virginia.
And I think that's legit, even if you're trying to weigh the relative comparative impairment. If you guys were really sitting down as legislators and negotiating those model cases, one thing that might affect your negotiations is how important those policy goals really were to the state. If by the time you get to the negotiating table, the state has repealed that texting ban, you probably won't fight so hard to have it apply, because it's just not that big a deal anymore. And so I think that's significant. The other thing, and then I'll let you go, the court points out, is not only that Virginia has repealed it, but now Virginia is more in line, because everybody has seen the wisdom and is getting rid of this arcane doctrine of sovereign immunity. That sounds a lot more like what we were talking about in Minnesota, right? That sounds like the court, despite its claim that it's not weighing the value, the good, of those relative policies, kind of is. Virginia's kind of behind the times. It's not such a good provision. And so I think two things. The doctrine's subject to a little bit of manipulability. Doesn't probably accurately reflect what legislators really would do. They probably wouldn't be solely focused on their own internal goals, but would be focused on some of those big picture goals like predictability and expectations, as your own little experiment bore out. And ultimately, it turns out, in manipulating the doctrine, you see the courts doing some other things, like this. And remember, I told you, you got to look out for that. Sometimes courts will say, we're doing one thing. And if you look carefully, they're actually maybe doing a couple of different things. All right. through the next reading, and we'll talk about the next reading next time.